Leslie, let's talk for a minute or two about the nature of proof, because when it comes to this subject, I guess no proof is good enough. You know, you got eyewitness sightings, and of course, eyewitnesses can be wrong. Radar reports, and they can be wrong. Photos, video. Somebody who doesn't want to believe it isn't going to believe it, no matter what the nature of the evidence. I'd like to know, what is the most persuasive evidence for you? What turns you around on this?
Well, that's a big question. I mean, I think what you mentioned, George, there are some cases that are just so strong. And as you know, when you take each little piece of evidence apart, sort of like, the eyewitness testimonies aren't good over here, or this isn't good over there. But when you have within one case all of those things, you have eyewitness accounts that actually correspond with what's going on radar. You have the pilots talking to ground control back and forth about what's going on. You know, all kinds of effects on airplanes. I mean, it can be such a conglomeration of data and so many people involved, and then U.S. government documents that come out of it. I mean, it's just impossible to look at certain cases and just say, well, this, nothing adds up. I mean, it's the combination of stuff that really, really points to the reality of some kind of phenomenon. There's just no way around it. And the accumulation of cases that we have, and documents. I mean, it's
well. You've kind of become a specialist in squeezing documents out of the government, right? FOIA, FOIA documents and things of that sort. You've been.
Well, I worked on this one case in particular, the Kexburg case. But a lot of the documents that I reference in the book, I certainly want to give credit to the other people who worked so hard to get those documents from the government. A lot of them were released in the 70s and 80s when there was a lot of work being done. So, I mean, I'm really picking the ones that are the most significant. And, you know, I didn't do a lot of documents because it can get kind of boring. But in relation to the cases that I actually covered in the book and the cases in which the people wrote their own stories about them, those documents are very, very significant. But I'm not responsible for getting those released. I want to make that clear and give credit where credit's due.
Understood. I would just say that was always the documents are what were most persuasive to me in starting out the research, because a lot of these things were written long before the Freedom of Information Act was law, and they were written specifically for, you know, classified eyes only. They were never meant to be distributed. And it's in those kinds of reports that you get really candid explanations and evaluations of the UFO reality.
Exactly. I mean, for instance, the Twining memo, the really famous Twining memo, is kind of one of the best examples. And, you know, why? I mean, these government officials in high levels, you know, writing memos back and forth to each other are not sitting there making things up. You know, it's just not, that's just not the way it works. So, you know, I agree with you. The early documents especially are really, really revealing and really interesting. And they never intended for anybody else to read them. So you can learn a lot from those.
Let's talk about a couple of cases. Belgium. Now, you have an interview. You have material from General de Brouwer from Belgium. Talk about what he saw and what he revealed to you.
Okay. And actually, just to clarify, I mean, he's actually written his own piece for the book. So,
sure.
Yes, I've interviewed him a lot, and I sort of introduce him in the book. But I think what's really extraordinary is that he's written this in his own words, and he's a major general. And he starts off his piece by just describing lots of, you know, examples of the hundreds and hundreds of sightings that took place in his country that were documented. And he's got drawings that he provides that witnesses have done, and just it was just an amazing, amazing event where these large triangular objects kept returning over this tiny country for a period of a year and a half, 2 years. And he was a colonel at the time, and he was in charge of this investigation that the Air Force took on to try to figure out what the hell these things were, you know, that were coming in. And he really worked at it, and they even launched F-16s a couple of times to try and get closer and chase them. And he writes about what it was like for him to be investigating these events, and the bottom line being that he was never, and other branches of the government as well who worked with him, were never able to explain what they were. And he also approached, you know, governments around the world, including the United States, to try and find out if these could be some kind of stealth aircraft that we were testing or something that, you know, was secret. And it absolutely was not. And he's thoroughly convinced that that's the case, and that's what he was told at the time. So it's pretty fascinating. I think it's one of the strongest cases we have on record, actually.
Yeah, you've got eyewitnesses, thousands of them. You have several different incidents. You have radar reports. You have some photographs, drawings from the witnesses, the testimony of military officials, and then you have the documents that you or someone else you refer to in the book that indicates from our government that it's not ours.
Exactly. I mean, that's an incredible combination of things. I agree with you. And, you know, numerous agencies in Belgium were involved, I mean, at the highest levels. It wasn't just the Air Force. And you had a scientific group, too. I mean, this is one of the things that's so extraordinary, you know, that it's so inconceivable that we could ever imagine happening in this country. There was a group of very qualified scientists that were really the ones responsible for collecting a lot of the interviews, the witness testimonies, and filing them. And they've got volumes and volumes and volumes of these hard copy reports. And, you know, it would have been very hard for the Air Force to be responsible for collecting all of those reports. It was very time consuming. So they cooperated with a group of scientists. I mean, it makes total sense, right? A rational way to go about it. These scientists were interested and they volunteered to do this. They were highly qualified and they had a cooperative relationship. And, you know, it's just hard to imagine something like that ever happening here.
The Japan Airlines case, you mentioned this briefly, and talking about Mr. Callahan, you know, that was a really interesting case. I remember when it happened and it made news all over the world, and then sort of the FAA started dribbling out various explanations, and then the debunkers got involved, and it was lights bouncing off the shrimp fleet and all kinds of crazy explanations that were, it was just like, toss out anything and see what sticks to the wall and make this thing go away. But the FAA put out, go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, the final conclusion of the FAA was that there was something wrong with the radar. It was just bogus targets, you know, even though the targets were corresponded perfectly with the visual sightings of, I mean, Callahan has all that evidence. And even though there was a perfect correlation and there were three pilots, and the FAA stated that these were very sane, sound individuals, they were not drinking or anything like that. It, you know, and nonetheless, they just made this conclusion that the radar was faulty. So, I mean, you know, go ahead.
In a case like that, do you believe that the FAA is just being sloppy and lazy, or is that it's more sinister than that?
You know, I wish I knew, George. I mean, you know, that's a really good question. I mean, you know, Callahan, of course, is very sort of cynical about the whole thing, and I think he's angry about it. I don't even know if he really knows exactly what's behind the attitudes that they have. I mean, a lot of it may be that they just don't know how to cope with UFOs, you know, because they can't explain them. They don't have any way of monitoring them. They don't have any equipment for properly even documenting them, really, because lots of times the radar isn't equipped to handle the speeds that they go at and the hovering. It's just something that it just seems like they do not want to deal with it. And they don't want people to get all worked up about it.
Well, I mean, there are practical reasons why that should be untenable. And the 2006 O'Hare case is an example of that. This is right over one of the busiest airports in the world. Describe basically the events that happened and then describe the FAA response, because they didn't want to admit that there was anything to it, right?
Right. And, I mean, this is such an important case because it happened only a few years ago. And, yeah, and people may remember it was a breaking story in the Chicago Tribune at the time that there was a very metallic-looking anyway. I mean, it was described by many people as a round disc object, metallic-looking, that was hovering right over the United Airlines terminal about 1,500 feet up, which isn't very high, and there was a cloud bank right above it. So it was suspended below the cloud bank where the sky was still clear. And it sat there for at least 5 minutes, and you had pilots looking at it. You had, you know, pilots leaning out of their windows on the ground, sitting in their planes, and they were looking up at it, and they were actually radioing to other people. There was a lot of radio communication about it. Calls were coming into the FAA tower about it. I mean, it was a big buzz at the airport. This thing was there. And after some time, estimates range 5 to 10 minutes, the disc suddenly shot straight up, just from a hovering position, just in the blink of an eye, shot straight up and went through the cloud bank. And what's amazing is it cut a cookie cutter, clean hole with a very distinct edge right through the clouds when it went up. And you could see blue. Those that were right underneath it could see actually the sky through the hole. And, you know, I don't think we have, I mean, and no one I've talked to has said that we have any technology that can do that. So, I mean, it was quite phenomenal. And, again, all these aviation people saw it. So the FAA's explanation was that it was weather. I mean, you've just got to laugh.